This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Everybody in the world is feeling the effects of climate change. You can see the most dramatic effects in the places where there are the fewest people, the polar ice caps. But changes there, particularly in the Arctic Ocean, may soon force governments to review international agreements that govern what was once a barely navigable ice cap. And life is changing, too, for the indigenous people who live in the Arctic. Tomorrow, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill looks at some of the issues in a conference called Who Owns the Arctic? First up, Michael Byers is a Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law at the University of Columbia. And he's also the author of the book entitled Who Owns the Arctic? And a speaker at the conference, my guest right now. Michael, welcome. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
So how much has the Arctic changed in recent years?
Well, in my lifetime, in 45 years, we've lost 40% of the extent of Arctic sea ice and roughly 40% of the thickness of that ice. So, yes, climate change is very visible in the Arctic, not surprising perhaps given that the Arctic exists in a balance between the frozen and the unfrozen, between ice and water. But it is very dramatic, and I've sailed through the Northwest Passage in the last few years in late summer and seen absolutely no sea ice.
Wow. And so what does that mean? What difference does that make in terms of navigation in that part of the world?
Well, if you take the Northwest Passage again, which extends from northeast of Alaska through to the Atlantic Ocean near Newfoundland, in the first 100 years of navigation from 1906 through to 2005, there were a grand total of 69 transits. Last year, in 1 year alone, there were 22. So it's a phenomenal transition that we're going through, and we can expect that to continue. And at some point in the next 10 to 20 years, I believe we'll see ships going straight across the North Pole, right through the center of the Arctic Ocean, which is an amazing shortcut between Asia and the Atlantic seaboard. And we could see hundreds, if not thousands, of vessels each year.
Well, then that sounds like good news when it comes to international trade. Is it? What am I missing?
Well, it is good news if you're concerned about the opportunities of international trade. And every dark cloud has its silver linings. So you know, if you want to celebrate at least one aspect of climate change, maybe this is it. But, of course, the loss of the Arctic sea ice has profound implications for global weather patterns, for ocean currents, for precipitation, with all kinds of negative, very high-risk scenarios just a little ways down the road. But the other thing that the opening up of the Arctic creates is real concern about pollution from these vessels. These are dangerous places to sail. Even if the sea ice disappears, there will still be icebergs, which are calved off of glaciers on land. And then, of course, you have extreme weather events. I've been in some really nasty Arctic storms. You have total darkness, 24 hours a day for several months each year. And, of course, you're thousands of miles away from any port, from any assistance of any kind if you were to have an accident. So there are lots of concerns about oil spills, about search and rescue that come with this disappearing ice. And then, of course, there's also concern about who owns what in terms of things like oil and gas that might be underneath the ocean.
Yeah, and that's what I want to talk to you about right now, which is the legal challenges where these borders have been reckoned according to the ice cap itself. The ice cap moves, the border moves, what's international waters changes, right?
Well, there's some really good news here in that the Arctic countries have been acting quite responsibly. Way back in 1990, the United States negotiated a boundary treaty with the Soviet Union in the Bering Strait and the Bering Sea. And so for 22 years, the United States and Russia now have a stable maritime boundary in an area that is potentially very rich in hydrocarbons and we know is very rich in fisheries resources. So no tension on that boundary. On the other side of the Arctic, Russia and Norway last year concluded a major maritime boundary treaty in the Barents Sea, also in a very oil and gas rich area, essentially splitting the difference in a disputed zone that was about 100,000 square nautical miles. Now, there are still a few things that need to be ironed out. Canada and the United States have a boundary disagreement in the Beaufort Sea north of Alaska. I'm pleased to report that the two countries are negotiating that right now. And there is the possibility of overlapping claims in the central Arctic Ocean, way beyond the normal limits of coastal state jurisdiction. But again, the three countries involved there, Canada, Denmark, because of Greenland, and Russia, are working together also. So I think most of the challenges will be resolved. There's a lot of cooperation. The Arctic is so remote, so inhospitable, countries see that cooperation is really the only efficient and logical response to these new challenges.
Well, there are also questions about whether or not that Northwest Passage that you referred to, which is now seeing more and more shipping, should be considered international waters or part of an inland waterway, which it would have been if the ice cap had stayed where it was.
Well, the United States has maintained for decades that the Northwest Passage belongs to Canada, but that there's a right of shipping through those Canadian waters. And Canada has agreed to disagree. And we've been able to agree to disagree because of the presence of that thick, hard ice. So although the disappearing ice is bringing this dispute back to the fore, it's between two very, very close allies. Despite the rise of China as an economic power, Canada and the United States are still each other's most important trading partners. And there's a lot of goodwill. We share the defense of North America through the North American Aerospace Defense Command. So this is like having a disagreement over whether or not your brother is allowed to walk across your front lawn. That could perhaps become fractious in the future, but there's a lot of optimism for resolving it at some point soon.
How can any nation that sees health care as a national right for all of its citizens be a credible partner in trading? I don't understand how we do business with the Canadians.
Well, I know that health care is a sensitive issue in the United States, but I think this is something that we can resolve. Yeah. And actually, I've partnered with a former U.S. ambassador to Canada, Paul Cellucci, to actually do a model negotiation with experts from both Canada and the United States to see if we could resolve the Northwest Passage dispute. And we were able to come up with 9 concrete recommendations as to how the two countries could build confidence and work towards an agreement. We haven't had to have those kinds of talks again because of the historic presence of ice, but I'm actually quite optimistic that we will sort this out.
How about the resources? Fish and oil and natural gas, I guess. That's most of what's there?
Yeah, well, the fish is a really interesting question because with the ice disappearing, there's a lot of scientific uncertainty as to what will happen to fish and whether new species will move in. And so the Obama administration has led an initiative to impose a moratorium on commercial fishing in the Arctic Ocean and is looking for cooperation from other countries. And the first other country to step up to the plate was Russia. The Arctic has actually become a sphere of cooperation across that old Cold War divide. In terms of oil and gas, it's a bit trickier because there is some oil and gas development in the southern fringes of the Arctic, in the Barents Sea, along the north slope of Alaska. So the idea of a complete moratorium is unlikely. Mm-hmm. But the different Arctic countries are working together within something called the Arctic Council on an oil spill cleanup treaty. And there's also talk about what might be needed internationally in terms of standards for oil spill prevention. So Canada, for instance, a few months ago imposed a requirement of a relief well capability during the same drilling season on any oil and gas development in Canada's north. And a lot of the lessons here are coming from the BP spill that we saw in the Gulf of Mexico and countries realizing that if something like that were to happen in the Arctic, the impact, the environmental impact, would be magnitudes higher than it was in the Gulf
Why
of Mexico.
Is that?
Because oil degrades and dissipates very slowly in cold water. There's no bacterial action to help with the remedial action taken by humans.
So we've been talking with Michael Byers, who is a Canada Research Chair for Global Politics at the University of British Columbia. He's going to be part of a conference called Who Owns the Arctic at Carolina tomorrow. But right now we've been talking about the people who more or less pass through the Arctic. But at this point, I want to bring in Susie Crate. Susie is an associate professor of anthropology in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at George Mason University. And she has studied the culture and adaptations of indigenous people in Siberia. She's also going to speak at the conference tomorrow. Susie, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here. Back in my own hometown.
Back home. Yeah. We're going to keep you here. So you went to Carolina, right?
Yeah.
And then you went up to that old Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah.
And you're ruining the day. Yeah. No, it's a great job. It's a great job up there. We're happy to
I'll get back here someday.
Listen, I want to talk to you a little bit about your research.
Sure.
on the Wiluwi Saha people. Tell us who they are and a little bit about them.
Wiluwi Saha are one of the many non-Slavic peoples of Russia, and they are a larger group. Their ancestors are actually Turkic. They speak a Turkic language. Their ancestors came from Central Asia around 900 A.D., across Siberia to Lake Baikal region, and then in the Genghis Khan period, 1200-1300s, they followed the Lena River north and settled just below the Arctic Circle. And they're horse and cattle breeders, and they adapted their southern subsistence practice to an extreme climate with over 100 degrees Celsius temperature change annually.
Wow. Was that something they brought with them from Central Asia, the horse and cattle, and
yes.
managed to make
well,
a go of
it? Well,
not
the same ones.
No, but I mean, they managed to make a go of it.
Yes.
In that region. And were they, how have they maintained or have they maintained their traditional ways in the modern world?
Well, as most people of the former Soviet Union, they were very challenged during the Soviet period. Russians came, of course, in the 1600s across Siberia and claimed the Asiatic part of Russia as Russian territory. But the biggest challenges, I would argue, were in the Soviet period because people across the former Soviet Union were forced to collectivize or to bring together their food production efforts and then into these huge agro-industrial state farms. But then with the fall of the Soviet Union, things happened differently across Russia. For Wiluwi Saha, they decided to disband their huge agro-industrial state farms, and they went back to household-level food production. And that's what I looked at for my dissertation research.
Were they able to pretty much recreate what they had before the Soviet period, or did they have to sort of invent
a new? To the extent they could. I mean, the big difference was the spatial arrangement, because prior to the Soviet period, they lived very far from each other across the land. And then they were brought into these compact villages, and three generations were born and raised into that type of a social setting. And so that's hard. It's hard to go back. There were all kinds of ideas after the fall of the Soviet Union of going back to those ways, but no one ever did. They had centralized health and school and electricity.
See, once again, national health care just destroys whole civilizations and allows people not to live the life that they choose. let me talk to you about the resources there, because not only do they do farming and cattle, but diamonds turns out to be a big part
yes,
of it.
Yes. In fact, 95% of Russia's diamonds are from the Wiluwi, just adjacent to the Wiluwi regions. They were discovered in the late 50s, early 60s, and very rapidly developed and mined. And they're in the mid-90s, the geologists discovered a new field of diamond cores. And so it's a booming business over there. And it has and continues to wreak a lot of havoc with the environment and has a lot of social implications also. Unlike Canadian Aboriginal peoples, or other peoples in the Arctic, inhabitants of the former Soviet Union do not have any kind of land claims. It's hard to get impact and benefit agreements like there are, for example, in the Canadian diamond initiatives up in Yellowknife, et cetera. Even those turn out not to be the greatest deal for the local people, at least there is some sort of agreement.
So who's doing the mining?
It's a rather, corrupt system, which probably isn't very surprising, and I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this on the radio. But
no, I think exposing corruption is actually what we do, but go ahead.
the diamond company is the government, is the, the EPA. I mean, it's all sort of, there is no independent people coming in to make sure that things are environmentally safe, et cetera, and it's all very very much involved in the government.
Have the Wiluwi Saha now achieved sovereignty? Are they now part of Russia? Who governs?
Well, the Saha Republic is a sovereign state, but to the extent that they hold most of the mineral and resource wealth of Russia, or a lot of it, Moscow has not let them go on their own. The biggest challenge now is really what's happening with climate change.
So tell us about that.
Well, as has been mentioned already, climate change is affecting the Arctic more than other parts of our world. The what we call the climate-sensitive areas, high altitude, high latitude, near sea level areas of the world. And these happen to be areas of the world where there are very sparse populations and often marginalized people, people who are very dependent directly daily with their environment. And because of that daily dependence, they are also know their environment very well. They have a very specific knowledge about their environment, and they're letting us know that things are not as they used to be. In 2005, as I was ending up another project on sustainability in these settlements, people started talking to me about how they didn't know what was going on. Their environment was not what it used to be. The seasons were coming at the wrong times, et cetera. And so we launched a full-fledged project on this. The main issue here, it's an inland area of the Arctic, as I said, just very close to the Arctic Circle. But it's ice-dependent, as other parts of the Arctic are. But this is land ice or permafrost. And so what's happening here, and, you know, we all think, oh, permafrost, that's, if you know what it is, you think it's this big layer of ice under the ground. But actually, it's a very active and dynamic layer of ice. It has an active layer. It exchanges water through it in a cycle. And it's very sensitive to temperature change.
So if it melts, it clearly things change, and clearly they've noticed. But has there been a measurable economic impact already?
Well, on the local level, definitely, because if we think of these communities as mostly supporting themselves by raising cattle and horses for meat and milk, and the hay fields upon which they depend to harvest 2 tons of hay per animal to get them through 9 months of winter, if those hay fields are turning into lakes and that hay is no longer harvestable, we've got an economic problem.
And the people in that part of the world have organized. Tell us about Many Strong Voices.
Well, Many Strong Voices is actually an initiative that is working with Arctic peoples and peoples in the Pacific areas who are confronted with another issue of climate change, which is rising sea level. And the idea behind Many Strong Voices, I'm not directly involved in the initiative, I know of it, but it's an effort to really to help the world understand that these are not victims that we're talking about. These are very adaptive and resilient communities who have lived for long periods of time in these extreme environments. And now it's the limits of those extremes are being pushed to the point where they're not sure they can adapt. So the idea is to communicate that to the public by documenting through visual, through stories, and through representing these people.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program today, and both of you will be speaking tomorrow at the conference called Who Owns the Arctic? I want to thank you, Susie Crate, who is an associate professor of anthropology in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at George Mason University, and Michael Byers, the Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law at the University of British Columbia, author of Who Owns the Arctic? And a speaker at the conference. The conference is called Who Owns the Arctic? It's at UNC Chapel Hill. Where is that going to be? Do you know where the conference is?
The afternoon sessions will be in a hall in the Carolina Inn. And at 5:30, there's an evening session at the FedEx Global Education Building.
All right. And all of that is free and open to the public.
Yes. Please come.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Stay tuned. There's more to come on The State of Things.